Hi, I'm Lawrence Williford.
And I'm Stephen Philcox, and today we are here with John Beckwith talking about Canadian song.
So we're talking to you, Stephen and myself, as the artistic directors of Canadian Art Song Project.
Yes.
This thing that we put together to pursue and promote the song repertoire and the recital repertoire in Canada. And you and I briefly chatted last week, and we were talking at the event for Toronto Masque Theatre just about kind of the role that song and music played in your early development
as a musician. Believe it or not, before my voice changed, I sang in a voice choir, and I was quite good. I became the head of the choir before I had to leave.
And this was in Victoria?
In Victoria, yeah. Where I was born. And we had a very good musician to work with there. Stanley Bully was his name. He was a student of Holst.
Oh, right.
And he was also quite traditional, but he was—he had a very good musical mind. He was very keen about music, and I think a lot of that rubbed off on me, certainly. And to be able to sing, not just in church service, you know, the traditional Renaissance and 19th, early 20th century church music, but with the larger choir, which he also directed, he would have the boys' choir come in and sing the Bach Passion, the Brahms Requiem, the Mozart Requiem, you know, some really wonderful pieces to experience when you're 10 years, 11 years old.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of that was not just what made me interested in singing, but what made me interested in music, period, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I even sang solo in some music festivals, and it wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
And I was a decent sight reader, so I liked, you know, getting to know new things.
Yeah.
Then when I came to study music in Toronto, I picked up some of my pin money from playing accompaniments, because I was quite a good sight reader at piano, and I worked with a lot of singers, and that was very good because I got to know the standard Lieder repertoire, the standard Debussy songs, etc., and a lot of the contemporary English language songs as well.
Did you play in recital with a lot of your
colleagues? I played in the festivals and student recitals, and for 1 year I was a student pianist for Eileen Law. I don't know if that's a name that you are familiar with, but she was, well, one of the leading mezzo voices in town. She sang the mezzo of the alto arias in Messiah with Macmillan every year. I don't remember her doing solo recitals, but she did a lot of singing with choirs, you know, solo singing with choirs. She was very capable, very well known. She had some very good vocal students. And so I was her studio accompanist. Well, that meant, you know, picking up a lot of the standard repertoire and reading it off at piano.
Yeah.
And I think that was very good. I got the idea of what voices can do and what some of the great songwriters have done with the voice.
Yeah.
Would you say that that became a source of inspiration for you in your own songwriting?
Well,
More just a reference.
I think it probably gave me a little more security when I came to think of writing songs myself. All along, I had this notion that I wanted to compose, and I got into it when I was studying in Toronto, and I was encouraged because one group of songs that I wrote won a small prize from CAPAC. They had an annual student prize, and I think I got, I don't think it was first prize, probably second prize, something like that, but that was encouragement, you know, when I hadn't done anything very much. And then some of the singers, like Lois Marshall, sang some of my songs, Mary Morrison, Al Marston, I don't know if that's a name that you remember, tenor.
Yeah.
A very fine tenor. There were a number of the singers in my own generation who were fellow students, and some of them did pieces by me on their recitals. And Lois, in fact, asked me to write some new songs for her for when she did her graduation recital.
All right, which ones are those?
That was a group of four songs with poems by E.E. Cummings.
The Cummings ones, right.
Yeah. And by that time I had done quite a few, well, I think four or five sets of songs by various writers.
Yeah.
So I think I got emboldened by the fact that I had worked with singers and they didn't have to tell me what they could do and what they couldn't do. I knew. and the kind of balance that you want between the voice and the piano, I think, so on. I think I knew that from the literature and from experience of playing for singer.
One of the things that's interesting about your generation of composers is it was a time when there was a lot of exploration going on with what the voice could do.
That came a little later.
But during your work, were other people that were doing that exploration.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Not in the... I'm talking about a long time ago, the 40s, 50s.
Yeah.
This is more like the 60s, 70s, when you had alternative ways of using the voice and various composers experimenting.
Yeah.
And that was very interesting, and, you know, I listened and I picked up a few things that interested me and tried them. And would have been sometime in the mid-70s, I was invited to go as one of two Canadian representatives in an international conference in Europe for new notation for various media. Uh-huh. And I got somehow into the voice section. They had various sections for various instruments. And I remember I had quite a lot to do with the voice section. I'm trying to think of her name, a quite well-known American soprano who was the chair of that section. It was a big conference. We discussed the new
notation
methods and discoveries that people were making with voice and with model people like Kathy Berberian and so on, Jean Gaetani. There were models like that that composers were getting very interested in what they were doing because it was opening up new musical possibilities. And she was married to Yehudi Weiner, but was her first name Weiner also? I can't remember. Gosh, I'm getting very bad on remembering names. Doesn't matter. But that was an interesting discussion group because there were people with practical experience with some of these new things, and there were the problems that everybody was trying to look at of how the notation could usefully reflect these new departures that composers were making in a lot of areas. Kurt Stone was the overall chair of that conference. I don't know if that's a name that's known to you. He was a brilliant musical editor. He was originally Austrian, but he came to the United States during the war, and he was the editor at Associated in New York, I think, one of the big publishers anyway. He later put a lot of the findings into a book about notation. It's a very good book. It's still a standard book about what to do and not to do in modern notation.
Yeah.
Kurt Stone,
Okay.
Remember him very well.
One of the things that Stephen and I have been working on when we look at the canon of song, certainly in Canada, is during the 60s was that period in which there was a lot of promotion of what it was to be Canadian in the arts and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
So it's an interesting time that musically and in art that we had this sense of nationhood in Canada being built as
National identity on everybody's
So it's an interesting time that, certainly for music and certainly for song, that's going on at the exact same time. So music from that period doesn't always resonate with our audiences now, though. And yet at the same time, there was a lot of commissioning happening from the CBC and various other national crown corporations and kind of places of national identity.
I think composers now can't visualize quite what a role the CBC played in our work in the 60s. I mean, that was a marvelous period. The CBC was working hand in hand with composers, commissioning new pieces, and certainly broadcasting everything that was new.
Yeah. And documented. And
we had talk shows where people even analyzed and criticized. And, you know, all that is lost now. We have nothing on a serious level at anything like that in the CBC. They just aren't interested. They don't even have a music department anymore.
Right. Right.
And I think that's a great loss. Whether it was a search after national identity or not, it's still something that we once had and we've lost it.
Well, one of the things that happened at that time, though, is the promotion of Canadian composers and other Canadian artists were so important and were happening on a grander scale, certainly, than what's happening now.
Yeah.
Yet at the same time, a lot of the music that was created at that time feels very distant to our contemporary audiences now. It's an interesting situation to be in because those are the works and that was a time when things were most documented, and it kind of went downhill after that. And so I wonder, we don't have the communication to talk to our audience now and to talk to them about our music making and what is happening and various voices of composers at the same time now.
But I'm surprised you say it doesn't have the impact that it once had. It's not played enough.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. To what extent, you know, people are a little afraid to program.
Absolutely.
But when it does get programmed, I mentioned I have just been thinking a lot about Brian Cherney because of his coming 75th birthday, and we're having this celebration in Montreal coming up. Cherney has presented at McGill for the past 5 or 6 years an annual all-Canadian concert with repertoire going back to that period.
Right.
And it's amazing what really vivid audience response there has been. Wonderful piece from 1962 or 3 is the Quartet No. 3 by Weinzweig. Now it's been played, I've heard it in the last decade, 3 or 4 times, which is a lot for a work of that period.
Yeah.
Audiences are very warmed by that piece. It's a marvelous piece, and we've had some very good performances of it. And when it was done, I remember, on the concert at McGill, the audience just were quite, you know, open with the enthusiasm. I think the things have to be, people have to have the courage to program and play properly, and not just sight read, but really dig in and perform some of that music. In songs, I think, it just reminds me of Song Cycle, which Weinzweig wrote in the 90s. It's one of his late works, and it's called Journey Out of Night.
Hmm.
I think that's it. It's for mezzo and piano, just a set of songs, like a cycle, with his own text. It's a powerful piece. I think it's one of his best pieces.
Mm.
And I've mentioned it to I don't know how many singers. It never gets played.
Right.
It never gets done. It's a difficult piece. But none of his music is particularly easy to approach, and you have to take it seriously.
Right.
But I think for mezzos, that's a wonderful vehicle, that cycle. I wish it would be done again. I await the next.
Yeah. Well, note to self.
Yes.
Tuck that idea. You don't know that.
From what I understand, he didn't write that much for voice and piano.
Not a lot.
So
no, there is
one set of songs.
Very early set of songs, which have been of Time and the World, which that has been revived quite a few times. It was originally done by Francis James. It's that old. And it's quite effective. They're very short songs.
Yeah.
This is a more extended piece, and I was quite impressed with it. I wish somebody would revive it. Yes, there are the fun pieces that he wrote for Mary Lou, and those have been picked up quite a lot because they're amusing.
Yeah.
And they give a chance to soprano to show off that kind of
sense
of humor. Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to...
Private collection.
That's right, that's right. It's interesting to think about the repertoire that was written for voice by Weinzweig and others. You wrote quite a number of songs over the period of your career, and still are. But I'm curious, there seemed to be a bit of a dip in the repertoire that was written for kind of recital for voice and piano during the 60s and 70s and even, going forward until... I mean, in terms of a total output from composers, it seems...
Well, you've looked at it more than I have. That strikes me as odd. Summers was writing songs all the time.
Yes.
And he worked also, like I did, with a number of singers.
Yes.
Patricia Rideout, I worked for her. Later on, Doug McNaughton, he and I worked together on a number of
things.
Projects. And I'm surprised that you say that, but
there are a lot of
right. I haven't done that kind of review of the
well, there are a lot of works that are written that are chamber works that include voice.
Yes.
But in terms of, say, something that you could include in a recital program with piano and
voice. With just piano, yes.
Yeah. There's, and certainly for tenor, I will wave a flag for tenors. There's very little for tenors. There's far more for soprano and mezzos, and a fair bit for baritones as well. But where I'm going with this is, was there, with this collection of the League of Composers and whatnot, did you ever have discussions about how various repertoire was being built up over across different composers? So beyond small works for, say, a quartet or large works for a symphony, was there a discussion about works for voice or how to build a repertoire?
That suggests more of a formal kind of plan to a career. And, you know, careers don't work that
way. No, of course.
A lot of the songs that I put together, I did because somebody asked me for some song.
Yeah. Which is often the case across all times, right?
Somebody calls me and says, I'm doing a solo recital. Would you write me some songs? I mean, it gives you a deadline and you start thinking, you know.
Yeah.
Or in the old days, the CBC phones and says, we have a broadcast next May. Can we commission you to do something?
You know?
There's a bit of money attached to it, you know.
Right. That makes perfect sense to me, actually.
But it does seem that you have a certain kinship, almost, with the genre. It has come up so kind of frequently throughout your output. And I'm wondering if it just speaks to what you've just told us now, or whether you really love writing for voice and piano. It seems to me, having played many of your songs.
I do, and as I say, I know singers. I've worked with singers. Hmm. Not just writing songs for them, but sometimes accompanying them, working with them in that sense, in rehearsing with them. And of course, I was in opera, and opera is a constant challenge with, you know, how do you do these dramatic things with the voice? And that's maybe not a piano and voice texture, but you're still thinking of what the voice can do and what it can't do.
Well, and even the way you combine voice and piano, John, is so, you know, I've played so many of your songs and they're always so wonderfully crafted, you know, and there's a real sense of counterpoint, not just within the piano part itself, but how it is underlining what the voice is doing. I wonder if you could maybe speak a little bit to the compositional process, and is it all inspired by text, and how do you come to texts?
Well, I have sometimes a problem recreating how I came about to do a certain creative project. I've sometimes tried to write it all down, so I try and remember the stages a piece came into being. I think with vocal music, I do start with the text. I know what I do a lot of the time is read the text out loud to myself, trying to notice the high points, the punctuation, the places where I stop for a breath, the pace of reading, emphasis, contour, that kind of thing. I think the association with how the text reads is important in a song.
Yeah.
I'm not sure all composers get that. Well, there are composers who don't really primarily set a text in order for it to be heard and understood. And I don't know any cases really where I've started by doing that, but it's perfectly valid. If you want the voice, you want it to float on some syllables, and you don't care whether the text gets across or not, you can write like Marto Salmetre is a great example, and Boulez doesn't expect for a moment that that very difficult poem is going to be understood when it's sung. It just was the means for getting that shape into the vocal part, I guess. I don't know, and I don't know if he's ever talked about that, that aspect. In the opera work that I've done, I always wanted the words to get across, and I think whatever else I've done, I have quite often come pretty close to succeeding in that, because people can hear the words, and you can't always in an English language opera. I tried very carefully to have some of the contour be like speech so that the singing voice gets across and not cover it also. That's a tricky part, of course, but I think I do start at that point. How do I pick a text? I don't know. I know texts that don't appeal to me. If the grammatic structure is too complicated, I find it's never going to get across. It can't be sung.
Right.
I can't imagine it being sung.
Right.
I won't specify, but I did hear a premiere of a new set of songs the other day where in one of the songs the text had a subclause. If you were reading it, would be like in parentheses. I think it was between commas.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be, it was something like, and then I went to my, if I may say so, home, or something like that. So the part in between commas is like a parenthesis.
Right.
Very difficult to get that across.
Absolutely.
In the contour of a melody that the soprano is singing, you know. And it didn't upset me, for instance, in E. Cummings, is a poem, a poet I love, that he has a very special typographical habit.
Mm-hmm.
He organizes his texts in very odd ways. The way he puts it down on the page is very off. And that's a challenge. I don't find it can't be done, but I find it's an interesting challenge to try and find some vocal equivalent, some audible equivalent to what you see on that page of Cummings.
But it's an interesting issue. When you read the poetry, it's hard to organize it in that way as well.
I'm organizing?
If you see something on a page...
Yes.
If you're reading that poem out loud, you can't get that across necessarily either. So in the representation of music making.
Not exactly, yes, you do adapt.
Yeah.
I found the same when I worked with B.P. Nicol, who was in a way the same kind of poet. He liked to have puns on words, odd typographical formations so that you have to work it out in a way.
Yeah.
And when you're setting that to a melody, you have to find an equivalent. And I found that a challenge with B.P. Nicol. I'm currently getting into some work with Paul Button, who is the same kind of writer. That's a very interesting, again, challenge. His texts are quite different, and they don't read like formal paragraphs. And the punctuation is often peculiar. They're often word plays that you have to respect and or try and deliver somehow musically. So I find those are challenges. I think I've done quite a wide variety of different texts, and I can't really say what appeals to me and what doesn't.
Yeah.
I can tell you immediately if I see a poem and I say, no, I could never say that.
Yeah.
It's not singable.
Yeah.
Or I look at a bit of prose and I think, well, gosh, you know, that's an interesting phrase. I could make something out of that musically and get that across with a singer. So it's hard to say.
One of the things I've really admired about your work, especially when coming to text, is you have gravitated to a lot of Canadian sources.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly your operas. I mean, dealing with folk traditions at the same times and dealing in respecting texts and melodies, but also in Canadian poetry. It's one of the things that Stephen and I have been commissioning works that has inspired us to really pursue focusing on Canadian authors and poets.
Well, part of that, I think, in my case, was because I did know a few writers, and they seemed interested when I talked about, you know, how about collaborating? And I was very fortunate with my operas that my friend James Rainey was such a brilliant writer and had such a brilliant idea of stage in his early writings. Didn't come across so much, but when he started to write plays, you got the idea that, yes, he had a real feeling for a stage moment. And he directed plays, of course. He eventually got to workshops where he would direct his own work. And so I was really fortunate in having him as a librettist for my stage pieces. But I have known other writers also, like B.P. Nicol, like, well, various others that have attracted me or that I've known that I've said, well, your work fascinates me, can we work together on something? Or can I use something that you've done, you know? So, but, so I was fortunate in that. And
yeah, well, It's one of the things that, well, that's inspired us as well.
I sometimes used to say when I was teaching young composers, when they were looking around for a text to use for vocal piece, why don't you go to a writer and ask your writer to write you something? Mm-hmm. Find somebody who's doing this kind of thing and work with them rather than digging through anthologies and resetting stuff that mm-hmm. maybe
the same English poetry
already.
That's been, yeah, yeah. You also did a number of folk song arrangements and from kind of different cultures that are part of the Canadian experience.
I never thought I would get into that, but you know how I got started was the CBC. John Roberts was in the music department there, and he had the idea, looking at other countries' repertoires, that there weren't enough attempts by Canadian composers to make arrangements of folklore material. The collectors were producing a lot of published volumes, and it was all very interesting, but out of that, composers weren't jumping at the chance to make arrangements.
Yeah.
In the earlier parts of the 20th century, 20s and 30s particularly, there was a lot of that.
Yeah, yeah.
As you know,
it's going on in Europe and
Macmillan
yeah.
and Willen, they all did
yeah.
their
the various arrangements
share of yeah. arrangements. But then, for several decades, composers just seemed to lose interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
Roberts came along, and he asked me around 1970, I think it was, would I write some arrangements for Maureen Forster? Well, who wouldn't write for Maureen, of course? And it was something I hadn't really thought of as being a need, but when he said, yes, we do need them, I went to some of the folk song arrangements by other composers that I knew, some that I liked, some that I didn't. Almost every singer at that period was performing the arrangements by Benjamin Britten. Well, I don't like them. I think they're kind of high-minded. Mm. They try to do tricks with the folk material. They don't respect it as beautiful on its own.
Mm.
And an older colleague was Mieczysław Kolinski. Mm. That's a name perhaps you don't know, but he taught ethnomusicology at the University of Toronto, and we were colleagues. I asked him if I could sit in on his seminar as a graduate seminar in ethnomusicology because it was something that I didn't feel I knew enough about. He was also a composer, and I got from him the idea of how you recognize shapes in folkloric material, originally put together material by non-specialists, which has somehow survived because it's beautiful. And people have used it over and over, and it's been committed to memory by people. And what are the elements of that composers should respect?
Mm.
I think when I am in a situation where somebody's asked for an arrangement, I think of how he went about that, and I very often resort to some of his methods because that was very illuminating to me.
Yeah.
And I don't like to be too clever when I'm doing an arrangement. I think the Britten arrangements are how not to do it.
Hmm.
Hmm.
Yes, some of them I like as pieces, but as treatments of original songs that come from the people's heart.
Right.
I think they're a little above it in ways that I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope I haven't fallen into that trap too much. I was lucky that Kenneth Peacock, who was a fellow student of mine and went on to a great career as ethnomusicologist, when I asked him if I could set some of the work that he had notated from Newfoundland and from Western Canada, and he was very obliging, and when he saw my arrangements, he said he thought they were decently done and had the proper respect for the material, so I felt really heartened by that, because he was also a composer, but I appreciated that he thought I had done something that was appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I went on after that set for Maureen. I did some pieces for baritone, also commissioned by the CBC.
Mm.
And then some years later, I thought, well, I'd better do some for tenor.
Well done.
And, and I did, and I performed them actually with Benjamin Butterfield,
right. Yeah.
And also with Darrell Edwards,
uh-huh.
and, well, various other people have done them. And then I did a set for soprano, which have been recorded by various people.
Right.
the set for soprano. In fact, the first performance was by Barbara Hannigan when she was just getting quite well known. She just graduated, but she was doing a tour of the Maritime Provinces, and she said she needed something. Could I do something? I thought, well, I haven't done a set for soprano. I'll do a set for soprano. And she did the premiere.
Oh, wonderful.
And various other sopranos have done them. They've been recorded.
Yeah.
So that has been interesting. I tried to think of the folklore not just of English and French traditions, but also of the other traditions that have been transplanted in Canada.
Yeah.
The native tradition, which was here originally, but also the Czech, Russian, German.
Mm-hmm. The Polish set? Is there a Polish set?
Polish, etc., various other traditions which have taken root and in which languages some new songs have actually been composed in Canada too.
Yeah.
So I thought that was broadening the picture of what we mean by Canadian folk song.
Absolutely. Mm. One of the things that I think is really interesting in terms of identity and the folk traditions influencing national identity through music, and this has kind of happened all over the globe, you know, English music is highly influenced by their own folk melodies. American music is highly influenced by Appalachian and gospel and spirituals, and that's really where their sound has come from. Canada doesn't seem to have a sound necessarily, or kind of a, this is the Canadian music sound. And it's interesting to think the relationship between the folk traditions and how that influences the music traditions of a country. Did you experience, what, since you did go back and deal with those ethnomusicological issues and wrestled with them, did that have an influence then when you came back to composing original things?
There's more of a repertoire than you think, maybe. Elaine Keeler has done a study of the original compositions that are based on indigenous material. Mm. And there's more than you think. There's more of a list than you'd think.
Mm.
In the United States, that started in the late 19th century with something that was called an Indianist movement.
Yeah.
And McDowell was sort of on the fringe of that. He did a few things, but there were others of his generation who were really deeply interested in and influenced by what they heard in indigenous performance. And there were a few examples in 19th century in Canada, but much more in the 20th century, when there has been much more wide collecting and broadcasting, not just in the radio sense, but
awareness of different cultures, original cultures.
Making the repertoire more aware than just one district.
Right.
And she has noted more than you would think in the way of a repertoire. A lot of composers have touched on that and have reflected on it in some of their writing. I haven't done as much as some others, but there are a few examples that I've involved myself in.
And that's one of the next books on my list to read, so survey.
When I did that set of folk settings for baritone, I did take one tune that I was fascinated by in a collection of Marius Barbeau from the West Coast.
Hmm.
I forget what part of the West Coast, somewhere in the northern BC, I think. And it was a surprisingly sophisticated song. You think a folk melody or a made-up melody of a local community, it wouldn't be very sophisticated. It's a very sophisticated melody.
Mm.
And I made a little setting that I thought didn't interfere with the shape of it. And the baritone refused to sing it because he, at that time, said that it would be inappropriate assumption of of culture, you know, cultural
appropriation.
Yes.
Yes, yes. And he later on went and changed his mind and said, I said it was published, so I figured it was not something that I needed to ask permission for. When I've done something from an indigenous source that wasn't published, I would ask the collector to go and ask permission. Mm-hmm. Can I use this? Because sometimes you are transgressing something that's private.
Yeah.
But this was not. So he went back on his objection eventually and sang it. my feeling was I didn't feel that I was transgressing. I hoped I was respecting the piece, but what I tried to do was maybe make it better known by the fact that it would be performed in other communities, in other kind of environments than it was originally heard in.
Yeah.
That there would be some value in that, and the beauty of the piece would be more widely known, you know.
Yeah. It's an interesting conundrum that we have in trying to...
It's a problem that comes up a lot.
Yeah, well, and certainly now it's a very important issue to address.
Yes.
And yet at the same time, if we're trying to look at Canada as a whole and try to incorporate the various cultures and the various traditions that make up our country and then reflect that in our art, that still seems to be a very important thing to do.
So, well, it's partly we get to know where it is we are on the planet.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You made a mention about Barbara Hannigan and Ben and Maureen Forrester. I'm going to wade a little bit in waters that are dangerous, I guess. One of the things that I find very interesting about the Canadian song repertoire is that Canada is represented so well internationally at the highest levels of performers. And at the same time, the music that comes out of Canada doesn't necessarily get performed by people at that highest level very often. And it's made me wonder, you will have Canadian performers singing American music and German music, English music, but where is our music? And in the kind of bringing forth our identity as a cultural...
This is a problem, and it's something which needs to be discussed probably between composers and performers. Mm. One thing I have noticed often that burns me up, if I may put it in a phrase, is when one of our international performers is asked to give a special performance or to make a recording of a piece by one of our composers and does a beautiful job, of course. What I want to ask is, now is that going to be on that person's next recital program when he goes to Amsterdam,
right,
when he or she goes to Adelaide?
Absolutely.
And it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Or it happens too seldom, I would say. And when it happens, I think it happens because there's some particular reason. It's an anniversary or some local reason that comes up. And I didn't think of that. Well, yes, I'll sing that song.
Mm-hmm.
But there isn't a natural sense that, I've learned that song and it's getting good notices or people seem to like it. I'm going to put it on my next program.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't happen.
And this isn't this isn't relegated to just singers. It's across the board.
Is that the fault of the performer, or is it the fault of the manager?
Or the presenter, or...
The presenter.
Mm-hmm.
The person in Amsterdam, or in Adelaide, or Cape Town, hasn't asked for a Canadian piece.
Mm-hmm.
Has the entrepreneur put it forward as a possibility?
Yeah.
So-and-so has just had a success with a new song cycle by a composer in Canada.
Yeah.
Would you like to hear it on the next recital program?
Yeah. I will say
alongside the Schubert and the Hugo Wolf.
Yeah.
You know.
I will say from experience, presenters rarely are interested in that, which I find fascinating. But, you know, it takes a bit of pushing.
They are not interested.
They're not interested in...
that's what I found.
Because they don't... Yeah, because
the
audience isn't necessarily going to know that.
Maybe that's where we have to fight the battle.
Yeah.
Because I have good relations with most performers.
Yeah.
They like what I do. I like what they do. We seem to, you know, by and large, have similar feelings about music.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's where we have our battle with the people who are handling the music, who are marketing it. The label Canadian is a kiss of death.
Yeah. Well, even amongst our young students, I find that it's a prevailing attitude. Yeah. You know, that they feel like Canadian content on a recital is something that's imposed rather than having a natural curiosity to really go into the bookshelves and the stacks in the library and search out the Canadian repertoire that really suits them.
Yes.
Yeah, or getting relegated to a specialist.
Right. You know, music that can actually be a vehicle for their instrument.
There are still, certainly at our university and at several other that I know, I can't swear to every university music department in Canada, but there are still undergraduate courses that cover the history and repertoire of music in Canada, and there are certainly knowledgeable professors who know about it. So I think the students should pick up something, a few names maybe, a little bit of repertoire. It isn't that it's unknown or even unperformed, and there are tons of recording. Here we are in the Canadian Music Centre. The Music Centre exists in five different cities of the country.
Right. Yes. You know. I do think we're starting to see an upswing in terms of awareness, but I'd like to see that kind of leap taken from awareness to actually getting out there and doing it, performing this
more
music.
More proactive.
Yes. I think both with the teachers and with the students themselves, there needs to be more of that. And as I say, the background from which you get that, the courses, the availability of material, recordings, scores, it's all there if you want. Just get off your behind.
Exactly, yes.
You know, you've had such a wide breadth in your career, and you've had incredible relationships with various artists and good relationships with many of your colleagues, composer colleagues, over the years. Looking back, is there a composer and repertoire that you really lament is not being performed specifically? I know there's a whole range of repertoire that's not performed on a grand scale, but is there a certain, are there specific works, specific composers that you think we've really missed highlighting over the years?
Well, if you name a prominent composer in Canada, I could probably think of a good piece that he or she has written that was only played once.
And that's still the case with many composers. Yeah.
It's still the case. It happens with this, going back to Czerny, because I've been thinking about his repertoire and looking at a few pieces. Lately, I've been asked to give a little talk. And I think of some really well thought out ensemble pieces by him that were just done once. Partly because they have an unusual instrumentation that maybe you can't gather together for every concert, but also not always for that reason, sometimes for no reason at all, except that people don't know about it and haven't bothered to look up or look, you know. So I think that one performance only situation is one that might be an avenue to research in itself. You know? I think of pieces of mine that I put a lot of effort into that were never done more than once. And orchestras are greatly to blame in that, I think. They commission a piece and they always want a new piece. And they always want to be able to say that they did the first performance. And yes, I conducted the first performance. Has there ever been another? Well, you know. And sometimes it's a very acceptable piece and one that has succeeded. It just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen.
Do you think that the way in which compositions come to be and the granting procedure and the regime of how money comes together for a new work is partially to blame for that?
Well, they had a very good scheme at the Canada Council some years ago, and I was fortunate to be in on it, where they would offer a commission for an orchestra piece to a composer if the composer could get three orchestras that would play it. Now, that's not just one performance. That's three orchestras, probably in three different parts of Canada, who would all undertake to play the piece if you wrote it. That was marvelous for me, because you had three different conductors learning the piece, probably not just three audiences, but each orchestra would do it more than once, so you'd have maybe six or maybe even more than six performances. The CBC in that period was still picking things up. I had two performances and a recording of that piece after it was played a number of times by three different orchestras in three different cities. Well, now I feel that was a very good approach to that piece, that from the Canada Council's point of view, I think they got
good bang for their buck.
Good benefit for their buck, yes. Because it wasn't just played once by one orchestra and then put on the shelf. And they gave up that scheme after using it for, I think, less than a decade. But during the time it was on, I think it was a very good scheme, and I don't know why they gave it up, but in my opinion, they shouldn't have.
Yeah. It seems this interesting to me that there's this cycle of, as you said, getting to a new piece constantly rather than exploring and really, and this goes, I mean, it's not just in orchestras, it's across the whole spectrum of music making, having opportunities, finding resources to put something on again and again and again and let those performances enhance the life of that piece, inform the next performance of the piece, get to be known by the performer. It's interesting. It just feels a bit like, I don't know.
It used to happen that way more often with recording. It still does, of course. I think it's nice one that I'm just getting ready a CD, which is entirely of pieces I've written since 06. So
amazing.
This is a new thing.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy about that that's happening. It doesn't happen enough, I think. There aren't enough entrepreneurs in the record business that go after composers.
Right.
Composers have to do it on their own or maybe with the help of some performing group. But, of course, recording is a very good way. It used to be the next step after recording was we got airtime, you know, broadcast airtime on radio. Forget it. I get nothing from airtime on radio anymore, next to nothing.
Yeah.
That's all gone. It used to be a big part of how composers' work got known. It would be on radio, be regularly available for playing on radio, and classical DJs in various cities would use that resource. But, you know, that's practically dead now.
Yeah. No, it is a very unfortunate thing. And how are we supposed to educate our public as to who's writing anything now?
We're ending on a kind of depressing note.
No, I know. I want to be a little bit more optimistic, but
I don't feel all that depressed.
No.
But there are these things that we've lost, and other things we have to do to make up.
You've spoken a lot in our time together just about various relationships and how they have played a major part of your career and making of your art. Maybe just speaking just generally to that and the value of collaboration and the value of artists being able to work with each other and develop relationships with each other and learning about each other and what that can do for careers and for both composers and performers.
Well, and that's one of our main mandates is bringing performers and composers together again. Because it seems oftentimes now something is composed and the performer's thought of later. You know, and we really wanted to be performers and composers and, in our case, because it's song, writers and poets coming together and creating in the moment.
Yes. Well, that's the way it's supposed to happen. And a lot of my experiences, happily, that is the way it happened, that I either was approached by some performer or I was working with them and somehow out of that came an idea for a new piece. And I think if it's too set apart, if the composing is too set apart from active performance, you have a kind of isolation of the performer doesn't know there's a repertoire, composer doesn't know that he has an outlet, or she. So I think you're quite right in that it's the way things should go. It's a very big community compared to what it was when we when I was starting out, you know. Right now everybody wants to write music. There's too much music, too many composers. Well, no, the more the merrier, but it's the way I can get to feel because it wasn't like that when I was starting out. And you have a lot of choice if you're a performer. If you do want seriously to know the repertoire, you have a lot of choice.
But also a lot of opportunities for relationships to build. As well, then. John, thank you so much for sitting down with us. It really means a lot.
Well, I hope
to have a little bit of the conversation about song with you.
Thank you. I like to talk, and I hope something comes out of that.
Well, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
My pleasure. Thanks.